and welcome to Scoreheads, a brand new podcast dedicated to the love of the music of both big and small screens, born out of a mutual respect and admiration for the folks that write the scores featured in all of your favourite films, television series and video games. I'm John Brown, and joining me once again is the amazing film music historian, author and journalist and friend, Mr. Sean Wilson. How are you, sir?
I'm very good, thank you, sir. That's the first time I've ever been described as a historian. I'm on the road.
I think your book automatically credits you as a film music historian, I guess, doesn't it? By its very nature.
Maybe implicitly. I will take the compliment. Thank you very much. I will take it and I'll run with it.
I love that you're the very humble one of the two of us.
Kind of yin and yang.
It's a good mix. It works out. Yeah. It works very, very well. So for anyone that caught the first episode, thank you very, very much, with Tyler Bates and Lola Collette. We had a whale of a time making that, and we hope that you enjoyed listening as much as we did making it. Thank you so much for all of your wonderful feedback and the love and support that the first episode has found. We really do appreciate it. I just want to walk back around to something, Sean, because I guess you'll probably want to discuss this as well. So we're going to do a bit of what I call a quantum leap, where we ended one episode teasing one thing and then started another episode in a completely different place, because do you remember Quantum Leap used to do that all the time? They get to the end of an episode
and he'd
leap into one body, and then when you tuned in the next week, they just didn't put them out in the order that I think they intended to.
And it would completely melt your brain, like, hang on a minute,
so in honor of our mutual respect and love and admiration for Quantum Leap, we did tell you that last week we'd be talking to Mark Mothersbaugh, and this week you'll have noticed from the track title that it is in fact Brian Tyler. So I just wanted to point that out. We are aware of it. Yes, we have spoken to Mark Mothersbaugh. Yes, it is an amazing conversation and I can't wait to release it to you. However, we did have a wonderful chat with Brian Tyler as well, and we understood the importance of Brian's episode coming out this weekend, and the weekend that we, of course, released it on. If you could be listening to this 2 months, 3 months, a year from now. But at the time of release, it was, I think, the right time, wasn't it, to bring Mario Brothers. We were literally just discussing off air that Mario Brothers, at time of recording, has had an incredible opening weekend, or opening few days in the Easter break. And you looked at some of those numbers, Sean, just now, didn't you? And it was ridiculously popular.
Yeah, according to Deadline, the Hollywood Trade Bible, it has had the second best 5-day opening ever, with $195 million in the bank already. So pretty phenomenal for the first significant family release of 2023, if you discount something like Puss in Boots, which I suppose has been the only previous one.
Mm-hmm. And Puss in Boots in itself had a very strong opening as well. So I think that all that in mind. Also, I saw the Mario movie and I absolutely fell in love with it, and the conversation that we'd had with Brian, and all these things moved together. I won't say conspired, but they moved together to make us think, do you know what? I think Brian Tyler should be the next one we drop. And also, it's a nice surprise, because I don't think anyone was expecting us to do that. So happy Easter from Sean and I, because we're bringing you a 60-minute conversation that we had with the maestro Brian Tyler, Hollywood film music icon. And Sean and I have both had the privilege of speaking with him before in the past, and I think we can agree that we both had a lovely time talking to him in the past. He's amazing. He's so full of energy and passion and enthusiasm, regardless of what time of the morning we talk to him. What are some of your memories of talking to Brian in the past?
He's a great person. He's so enthusiastic and, like you say, so passionate about what he does. And I'm just delighted to catch up with him about the impact of video game music and how that develops your formative experiences of playing games. It's such an important facet, and it was brilliant to talk to him about that.
Yeah, I've been a huge fan and admirer of all that he's done for many, many years, from, you know, his work, even his work on the Dune series on television, to his work with Marvel, his work across genre. He crosses so many genres, doesn't he, in Hollywood film music. Of course, he famously redid the Universal logo as well for its 100th anniversary. But I think probably one of the things he's most famous for is his dedication and commitment to the Fast and Furious series. Of course, made some incredible soundtracks for that, incredible scores for that series. He's done so much that the last two Scream movies, of course, Scream 5, Scream 6, he was responsible for the score for those. He does an amazing amount of work with Taylor Sheridan on things like Yellowstone, films like Those Who Wish Me Dead. They have a brilliant partnership and collaboration. And really, if you go to your favorite search engine right now and Google Brian Tyler, I've just said Google, go to your favorite search engine, but apparently
other search engines are available, but apparently ours is
Google. Yes, but go look him up, because the amount of work he's achieved, he's also very rapid at working. And so the amount of things he's achieved, and often at any times, as you'll hear in this interview we're about to play you, he's often got his fingers in many pies at any one given moment, much like Lorne Balfe, who we speak to quite a lot as well. So it always fascinates me about his process and how he's managed to not only pull off many projects at once, such as he is at the moment, for example, but also make each one still top draw material, you know, right?
Yeah, he's an incredibly prolific and ubiquitous composer. I mean, I first became familiar with Brian's work, I think, back with his horror scores like Frailty and Darkness Falls. Frailty is a really, really good gothic horror score that he composed for the late Bill Paxton, who directed the film. But then seeing Brian go on to the bigger budget arena, like you've just said, Fast and Furious, Marvel, diversifying into romantic comedy scores like Crazy Rich Asians as well, which was a really charming score. Yeah, I mean, you know, the ability to work so rapidly on so many projects, I'm kind of in awe of Brian and his fellow artists to be able to do this. I'm like, how do they sleep? Do they sleep?
and actually, it was just to highlight actually the conversation you're about to hear, we did actually record with him at 1 a.m. his time, wasn't it? 1 to 2 a.m. Yeah. And he was still absolutely full of beans, and he was working on a project and he stopped to talk to us, and as you will hear shortly, the energy and enthusiasm that he was still bringing after being awake all day was a thing to behold.
There were at least a couple of occasions where I was tempted to say, oh, it's 5 p.m. UK time, I've just finished work. I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. it's 1 a.m. his time.
But it was very, very kind of him to share his time with us to talk about. I mean, we do touch on recent projects. I think that you'll have a nice surprise once you get towards the end of this episode about it, certainly about what comes next. But in the main, his absolutely phenomenal work on the Super Mario Brothers movie, and I know Sean and I were very lucky to hear it in full very, very early on in the process, and we were quite fortunate to be able to do that. And I think it's safe to speak for both of us and to say that we fell in love with it, right?
It's really, really charming. I mean, I said to you over message, I said it reminds me a lot of the fantasy adventure scores with which I grew up. Very bright harmonic colours, lots of movement, lots of really interesting integration of orchestra and synth. Yeah, I love it. It's terrific.
So without further ado then, we now present to you, Sean and I are very honoured and privileged to be able to present to you a 60-minute conversation with the legend that is Brian Tyler.
There you go.
Excuse me, everybody, coming through! This guy's brother is going to die imminently! Out of the way, please!
Just trying to clear a path, that's all I'm doing. He's gonna be fine.
Chantrell, nice to see you, bud.
Does this thing work?
Yes, we're great. You just have to blow into it.
And up we go.
Wait up.
How are you, Brian?
Good, how are you doing?
Yeah, really good. Good to talk to you again, man.
Me too. It's been a couple times, yeah.
It's been a minute. Yeah. Thank you for doing this, Brian. I appreciate it's 1 a.m.
Yeah, over here.
But
all good.
But I also remember we had many conversations in the past about how sometimes you'd go to work on a queue and then before you knew it, it was 7 a.m. So I know you're used to this.
It's pretty regular. Yeah, that's a pretty normal existence. Just kind of, you know, I find that it actually, it's like really, I realize that I am a night owl because of the fact that really, I think it came from the fact that I am able to kind of artistically go into the zone when I'm not being, you know, the phone ringing with things and this, that kind of breaks me. So it really, in a weird way, it forces me into being a night owl, and I just prefer the night. And so now it's actually become where I feel more relaxed and kind of more myself when it's dark.
Are there any, can you remember, like, is there been a queue that really kicked it and that was really like tormented like that went all the way through the night?
Oh no, you know, it's weird. No, it's not. It's kind of the opposite. It's like, it's just when I work in something that I really love working on, I just don't want to be bothered. So I'm working on it, and whether it's a cue from a movie, I'm working on something for Are We Dreaming or whatever it is. It's like, I'll jam away. And then before I know it, it's the morning, but it's not really a negative. It's a positive.
Yeah.
It's just in the day. The thing about it is, in the day, the things that take you away from your art happen. And at night, I know generally it's something that, you know, I'm not going to, kind of the BS that can come along with whatever, you know, in life or even like even when commerce and art collide, that doesn't happen. So I'm free to create, and that's when my best work is done. So it's something that I've realized, like, over time, I feel like I think it's made me a night owl. I don't think I was born one.
it sculpted you as a
yeah, exactly. Totally.
And on that note, welcome to the show. We are joined by the most amazing, the most awesome Mr. Brian Tyler. Thank you so much for coming on, man.
Yeah, good to be on again. Thank you.
Sean and I are thrilled to have you with us. And I thought maybe actually we could, because I think it's been a minute. I think the last time we spoke, you were just about to bring out Scream 5.
Okay, right on.
It's been a minute.
Yeah, that's right.
What's been happening between, I know there's a lot, but maybe if you could give us like the bullet points or the highlights, what's happened between Scream 5 and now, man?
Gosh, okay, so let's see. Scream 5, that was, I have to kind of like look back through my, I think that what, right around then, it was like, I think I was probably working on Yellowstone, and which then, you know, the Taylor Sheridan Yellowstone into 1883 into 1923, I think I probably was doing the Rescue Rangers.
Yeah, it was cool.
And I believe that basically, I think that, you know, that was a lot of fun because that was, you know, an animated feature, and really was enjoying doing that. And then it was basically, let's see here. I think I went into starting doing Are We Dreaming, which I'm directing, which I'm still doing, and Awakening. I think the live show that's opened in Vegas, that's the really wild immersive show that opened in November, and the soundtrack just came out for that.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm really proud of that. And I mean, it's this incredible show with, you know, cast of hundreds and dancing and illusions, and, you know, the whole thing is a musical, just the music plays throughout. And same with, obviously, with Are We Dreaming, which I've directed, and that is ongoing, and that's basically a modern Fantasia meets 2001 A Space Odyssey kind of thing, where it's music central as almost like a concert experience, but with all the visuals of what would be like the most insane, wild cinematic journey through space and time. So doing that. And then I think, let's see, I would say, gosh, I'm just thinking kind of backwards into what's recent. Those Who Wish Me Dead, I believe I did that as well. And then into, let's see here. I think basically it was...
Scream 6 was next, I guess.
Was it? I guess it must have been. Yeah, a Scream, and then of course, I think I'm missing something here.
Gosh. Super Mario Brothers.
Help me out.
Super Mario Brothers.
You know, because it all blurs together. So yeah, in terms of order of how things go, it's hard to kind of remember.
Yeah.
The, you know, but I think 1923, then, or 1883 released, and then that was amazing. And then 1923 with Harrison Ford and Helen Mirren. And then, of course, I started working on Super Mario Brothers, which comes out, what, in a week or so?
Yes.
And of course, and I'm just finishing up Fast and Furious 10. I was just in London conducting at Abbey Road with the Philharmonia out there. Yeah, I think that kind of gets us up to speed, I believe.
That's we've established now that you don't sleep at all.
Yeah.
Cramming all that in. It's amazing.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I know we did talk about that. Yeah.
That's just it's an extraordinary diversity of projects. So I imagine the thrill of this job must be you push yourself in so many different directions through so many different idioms and stories, right?
Yeah, it really is something that I mean, the joy of it is that I'm able to move around, and in terms of telling, you know, musical stories, it's like whenever you're composing music, it's like there's a narrative to it and an emotional component, and music essentially does that. It clarifies narrative and conveys emotion, and so when you're talking about jumping from something like a, you know, 1883, this is a tremendously emotional historical drama, and then I think at that time I was doing that and probably Rescue Rangers, you know, which is this really kind of ironic comedy, really incredible animated film. That was at that point, knowing that I was going to be doing Super Mario Brothers down the road, that was something that was really very cool, because I get to see, oh, I'm going to be doing that. And of course, my own project as I'm directing that, Are We Dreaming, that has kind of a science fiction futurism kind of aspect to it, and with that, it's not just doing music, it's doing visuals and editing and shooting and lenses and the whole thing, and so I think really, you know, what I love about being in film and film music, it keeps a variety going. If you go back to even like Crazy Rich Asians, you can do jazz or whatever it is, and of course, I love producing electronic music and hip hop music, and I'm doing that every day, you know. Also, so it's like I get to really, it's a joy and a privilege to be able to sit down and write symphonic music, and then take a break from it after a few hours and do some kind of underground electronic music or, you know, a hip hop record, and to me, those things all inform each other, you know, the kind of the energy and the pushing yourself to learn new things from both sides. I can learn as much from, like, when I was writing my violin concerto for Redeeming Love, that Gil Shaham is one of my favorite violinists, and he's the soloist on that soundtrack and on that piece in particular, but throughout the soundtrack. And I learn a lot from, like, talking about violin and harmony and how it works with concertos and kind of a lean melodic line. And then working with different artists, and I meet, you know, 19-year-old with a laptop working on some beats, and I'm like, wow, how are you doing that with that bass and the sidechain compression with this or that, and all these kinds of things. And if you really just keep yourself open to learning, then it keeps all these projects interesting, because you always want to try that new thing out and really push yourself on the next project. And it's like an infinite kind of, it's kind of an infinitely evolving process that not only does it not get boring, that's the opposite of that. It's always exciting to the point where I start working, and like I was saying earlier, before I know it, it's dawn, and I've been working all through the night, and it just keeps going.
you were just saying there about working with, you know, a 19-year-old with a laptop. Do you find time to, and do you enjoy mentoring young artists as well yourself? Do you find time for that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's especially when I'm working on all sorts of projects, because like with Awakening or Are We Dreaming, those are projects that are kind of fall under the kind of Brian Tyler solo kind of paradigm. So when I'm working on things and I want to use, you know, hip hop artists or whatnot, I love kind of exploring everything I can. And sometimes it comes from surprising places. Like when I've been working, I was working on some hip hop tunes, and I found that some of my favorite rappers are from like India, you know, from Mumbai and like the gully there. And it's kind of, they grew up doing this really cool, like Konakal vocalization, which is kind of like learning how to do percussion and tabla with your, by vocalizing it. And so by the time they're like four or five, their articulation is like absolutely insane, off the charts. So once they start battling in the playground or anywhere, just they become extremely proficient. So it's like always learning from any angle, from every direction. And I was just in London and working with the Philharmonia, kind of having a lot of discussions back and forth about where a rhythm with string sections lands, or brass, and kind of what I've learned from around the world, from kind of even picking up things like in India, for instance, how that informs how I write symphonic orchestra. And since I love, you know, really also learning how to become more proficient or learn new angles of how to play instruments, that informs how I compose as well. So on the guitar, or learning like a new instrument, or drums or piano or whatnot, all these things that I play, I find that as I kind of push myself to learn from others, it pushes also my compositional skills down the road further. And kind of, I get to, it's almost like learning from others is like if you really open yourself up to it, it can, if you take it to the extreme, it's like a superpower. You know, it's like when you're in a video game and you power up and you get someone's, it's like you're learning a new skills that make it easier for your brain to go outside the lines of which you thought the box was, and go outside those lines and that you thought were restrictions. And so I think by doing also projects that are very, very different from each other, that encourages that kind of thinking. And it's like, it's really like, I consider it a privilege to be able to do that.
Well, I'm always really fascinated when I hear about artists directing a project that they've also scored on. I wondered how, when you're directing Are We Dreaming, how does that inform your approach to the music, given that you stand in the position of being a director as well?
Yeah, it's interesting because with Are We Dreaming in particular, is that it is music centric. So there are storylines, the conceit of the whole story is that we need to, it's basically between, it starts in 2400 BC and it ends in 155 trillion years. And so it's like this huge period of time, and it's basically our fight as intelligent beings to prevent time ending, because eventually, I don't know if I explained this before, but the idea is that science fact is that over an extreme amount of time, photons, the particles that will last the longest will end up petering out. So there'll be no more light, which means there'll be no more energy, and then that means time will stop. There won't be a universe. There'll be less than a void. It's just nothing. And so the idea is that intelligent life has to come together to create an artificial star system that then goes supernova and kickstarts a new Big Bang, and the universe starts over. So it's like, it's the literal fight against the end of time, right? So when you're doing something like that, you have the kind of the overall storyline, but then since it's more like a Fantasia kind of situation, the music is the central part of it. So I'm doing the music first. It reverses the filmmaking process from normal films. So I'm doing the music first, and then the visuals I create around the music. And sometimes it's going from shooting a set of actors that discover something beneath the surface on the planet that they land on, that they realize that they've gone back through time because they went too close to a black hole or whatever it might be, going through wormholes and on and on. It's like traveling through literal time and space. But those are the basic ideas. Then it's shot, and the visuals are done around the music. So it kind of, it's an inversion of the process of normal filmmaking, which makes it so the music is really the most important thing. It's driving the entire thing. Every single frame is to the music. Every visual and even things like taking into account the abstract visual nature of it that sometimes comes into being correlates like with my synesthesia, because I see colors when I hear sounds and whatnot. So all of those things follow the music. And the only really time I remember seeing that in a kind of in a big of scale was Fantasia. And then, and as an experience, but the thing was, is this is also a live experience. So there's every single night you would see it. It's a live type of thing. It never plays the same way twice. I'm changing it on the fly as the show goes. So you could go to the show 100 times and it'll never repeat itself. The only thing that it is like starts in the same place and kind of ends in the same place, but the, how you get there is always different. So in a way it's very malleable and changing. Whereas if you're talking about a linear regular film, which I'm also looking at directing, that's a different thing. It's just, I think so much like a musician, it's kind of how it goes. But I grew up doing visual arts as much as I did music. Like my grandfather was an art director, so I grew up doing matte paintings and like practical effects and models and developing film. And I edited film and I would do perspective and all that stuff. It was something that was a part of me as much as music. It's just that up to this point, I've been following the career path of doing music for other people's projects, movies, you know. So it's kind of like I say, like I've been working on creating music to support other people's narratives for 25 or so years. But so this is the first time with this and Awakening is that I'm getting to really more tell my own narrative, my own story, and then have the music be a central part of that experience.
Will we now see you move on, just to pick up on what you were just saying there, Brian, is this the beginning of us seeing Brian Tyler, the director?
Yeah. So it's both. And it is, it's almost like an inevitable path for me. I'll never step away from music. It's just too much a part of who I am. It is my central core. So I'm just really fortunate that I've been given these opportunities to also tell the story visually and direct. But at the same time, I'm never going to put even any kind of pause on the creation of music. It's a daily occurrence for me regardless. So it's both.
Yeah, I suppose you mentioned earlier the powering up, which I suppose neatly or not so neatly brings us on to Super Mario, which is what we're here.
Hey, I like that. I like that. Yeah.
there's a shift there. Yeah, we need some kind of like synthy, like sort of transitional sound.
Brian's done loads of those.
Yeah. I just love the color and the energy of your soundtrack for this. It just reminded me of so many like adventure scores and animation scores with which I grew up, and I'm sure it's the same for John as well in the 80s and the 90s. Just this spirit to it. Video game scores have been formative for so many people. I mean, for me, it was Sega Mega Drive with like Sonic and things like that. I wondered, as a musician, like, do you remember any like video game scores like imprinting on you, like early video game scores or from any period?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because there's kind of I've always been a gamer through different eras. You know, I go way back to kind of the advent of kind of more like the arcade era. You know, and so I mean, like, I probably when I was a really little kid, I probably played, you know, like a Donkey Kong was probably the first Mario game. I mean, well, that is really the first Mario game because Jumpman didn't have Mario, right? It's just called Jumpman. but you know, I loved. It was kind of just such a part of it. You know, that kind of 8-bit sound was such a part of like video games in the arcade. And then as they became like home systems, it started to branch out and get a little more complex. And then by the time I really kind of hit video games was like PlayStation, and then N64 and on Xbox, you name it. But I do recall kind of noticing as music kind of continued, the thing that was always the part of what originally was noted as arcade kind of music, it had a certain sound because you were limited on how much harmony you could do. You're just limited. But But the thing about that was very difficult about it that they pulled off, like with Koji Kondo on the Mario stuff, is that he was able to create things that were very memorable. You know, like the Mario games, and going back to Donkey Kong, you know, where you have like, you know, Mario Kart and on and on and on, you know, has the central kind of melodic reference to Mario is this kind of Americana Italian / adventure music. And it really was such a part of the game. Like, you can't imagine any of the Mario games without that music. And then as time went, it became more and more complex. And I do remember with like the PlayStation 2, I think, it was kind of like right early days when I was scoring. And I remember like Metal Gear Solid and Harry, my buddy, Harry Gregson Williams doing that. And Michael, another good friend of mine, Michael Giacchino doing the Jurassic Park game. And I started doing stuff. And then as games became more complex, they became more cinematic and, you know, like Halo and on and on. And then it just became like scoring. And then I started scoring games myself, which I loved doing, you know, Assassin's Creed and Call of Duty and Far Cry and all those kinds of things. So there's like this huge evolution where the curve of what music could be was reliant on technology, and the fact that there's kind of a nostalgia for the different eras of video games is interesting, because the nostalgia that's associated with eras is actually it's basically a pure limitation of technology that was met with creatives and composers trying to do as much with the technology as they could. So for me, it was like full circle with Super Mario Brothers, because here I am doing something that I heard when I was a child, and I played Mario through the years. And then even, you know, talking to Koji Kondo, like it throughout the process, especially early on when I was thinking, when I was kind of talking about what I was going to write for the score and how I wanted to use references to the games and all that. I was like talking to the dude, right? That kind of kicked it all off. And so, you know, just as a gamer myself, it was like, when people say it was a dream come true, like it really was, because playing those games, it was inevitable that that's what I, when I'm doing it, that I associated it with the games in a way that was really kind of emotionally resonant. Like when you play a game for hours and hours and hours, you're not doing it, it's not a 2-hour movie. You're playing that thing for like 40, 60, 100 hours plus, right? So the music becomes a part of your kind of memory as if you were there. It's almost like if you heard some music when you went on this vacation that was really beautiful, and you fell in love with some girl as a young man, whatever it might be, the fact that you had these adventures with your friends going through these levels through hundreds of hours possibly of playing means that the music becomes like almost like the most emotionally connected to an active experience as anything. So it was really important for me to try to kind of capture that just for myself, but certainly for the fans of Mario. And it was really cool. I mean, to say the least, it was an incredible experience.
I would say emotional is exactly the right word. We were very lucky to be able to hear all of your work on the Mario score quite early.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
What emotionally resonant is definitely one of those things, because it just, I mean, never before has the term understood the assignment ever been more on the nose than with this project, because we listened to it.
Thank you.
Several times, I mean, dozens of times each, right? And it was just, I as the score unfolded, you were talking about that emotional resonance, and suddenly I was, first of all, I was in awe of it, how amazing it was. But
thank you.
Then I was kind of harkened back to being 8 years old on a school bus playing a Game Boy. Like, it was all there.
Yep.
So my
100%, man. Thank you.
It was 100%. Like, you left nothing out. You totally got it. It was like, this is how you score Mario Brothers. Tell us about the actual score and the construction of the score itself, and and how you threw yourself into that musically and some of your ideas and stuff.
Yeah, for sure. You know, so to me, at the very beginning, when I heard that the movie was being made, and I heard that Illumination was behind it, and also the original makers of the game, everyone from Nintendo, who was directing it, all that, I was thinking, I would love to talk to them. And I had no idea that they were looking at me to score it at the same time, which was incredible. So what I did, we all got on a Zoom call from Japan, everyone from Koji Kondo to the head of Nintendo and everybody. And people that feel like you do and I do about it. You know, there's no one that I knew on the movie that wasn't like hardcore into it, but I was really hardcore, you know? And yeah. So I was saying, you know, here's the thing is when I was playing it, any of the games throughout the years growing up, there were kind of two levels of it. And let's say like visually and sonically, you're looking at a screen that is limited by the technology of the day in a game and the music too. But in your mind, you don't care. That's not what you're concerned about. You're not concerned. Gameplay is key. Character is key. So we would play these games. And I remember kind of being unaware or not caring that, of course, the game's visuals can't live up to what a cinematic big movie would be. It's just not the same, especially way back in the arcade days. And that wasn't the point. The point was you were experiencing this. So in a way, the experience was in my mind. And so I was in the world. You would go into the world. And with Mario, it was everything from the you know, Rainbow Bridge, on and on and on. Any of the characters, Bowser, Princess Peach, and just the journey. And so it's like your brain would expand and kind of fill in the rough, jagged edges of what maybe a lower bitrate visual would be or something like that. And it becomes something like that. So what I wanted was with a movie was to take that feeling that I had and that others had playing it in the early days and throughout and translate what that would mean into a cinematic experience, but retain the exact feeling you would have. So it wasn't just like porting over something. It was like, it was the feeling you had. And so in my mind, even those early 8-bit melodies, I wanted to just, it wasn't just like taking them and let's orchestrate them. It was like taking them and kind of lovingly create to me, my reference point being myself, what it felt like playing those games and even going back and going back into the early ones and playing them and seeing what it was like. It's like magic, you know? And so I feel the movie takes you in there into that world, but the music too, I wanted it to be where, of course, I was writing original music that felt like it had a built in nostalgia of what Mario felt like, but at the, like, at an emotional and cinematic scale that would fit something that was larger visually. So it was almost like what would have been done, I would hope, if they had the bandwidth and the capability to really do music as if it were just what was in your mind. So in that way too, making references to everything along the way in a way that worked as both kind of a tribute to the fans, but not just merely like a fan service, but things that actually made sense. There was a magic to how some of these themes and little musical references worked originally that I wanted to retain. So sometimes it might be I'm playing a new theme for a character or a scene that emotionally has a lot of range. And then the harp line is there's an antiphonal viola line that is referencing the actual game music that it came from many, many years ago, and they're in tandem, but it works on a level that if someone doesn't even know that kind of thing, they're just hearing it, watching the movie as a new person to the world of Mario and totally understand it and totally feel what I did when I was a kid playing it. And hopefully like what you did and what other fans did, and that the fans would understand what I was saying with that in a way that also is like, cool, I can bring my friend that never played it and they'll get exactly how I felt when I was playing it as a kid.
So it sounds like what you're describing there, Brian, is kind of like, so it's this score is like a bridging moment between the peer limitations of early video game music and the orchestral sophistication you bring to your big budget blockbuster scores. It is trying to find that sweet spot, I suppose.
Yes, it is. And it also is by any means necessary. So it was kind of like, I wanted to be, where there's no limitation on instruments. So the score has full orchestra, full percussion. It has a live choir. It has all sorts of instruments that I play, everything from mandolin to kind of nod to the Italian side to accordion. And then sometimes I'd be playing drums live, but I would do a drum fill. And as I hit tom number one, tom number two, tom number three and four would be 8-bit toms, you know, like, but so it would be kind of also literal instrumentation from the entire history, not just 8-bit, but all the way through the 90s and the early 2000s and different kinds of ways that the Nintendo, whatever, the Game Boy or the N64, what they could produce at the time. And that's all in there. But I wanted to be kind of like seamless as an experience, and which makes, I think, the score a one of one. It doesn't sound like any other score. It's just that it's because I wanted to be truly Mario. And writing the themes, I wanted to feel like those belong. Princess Peach, all of these themes, the main theme that those could stand side by side. And that's really was like one of my most proud moments, is when I played the new themes in a big theme suite for the original makers and composers of Mario through the years since 1981 or whenever they started. And them just being so extremely happy to the point of like kind of welcome to the family. And that meant a lot. It was unlike any other film I've composed because of that kind of history that was there musically that I kind of now been a part of it. And really the size of the movie of Mario, it has a scale. Like I was saying, I wanted this score to be everything Mario, and in a way the scale of it reminds me of like what E.T. was to John Williams. The soaring emotional adventure fantasy of it kind of goes what you can do with live musicians and on kind of a scale that this score is. You can emotionally like cover things in a way that really pushes the boundaries of that emotion. Everything from romance to the danger to the adventure, all those things, I wanted to really soar in a way that was a tribute to both the coolness and the fun adventure of playing those games through the years, but also capturing what cinema can do. And it's almost like that line blurring. It's like I feel like I imagine myself kind of playing the game as a kid and then jumping in through the screen, and that is what the movie is. And so you're in the real world of what it is. And so the music had to kind of do that translation from like 8-bit, you know, whatever the computer graphic look would be, into actually like really beautiful, colorful, extremely incredible like animation styles. I wanted the music to do the same thing.
If you can finish this, you're coming with me. Watch and learn.
I noticed that there is a great song in the movie from Jack Black as well. Were you involved in producing that song? Did that song just come to you and you kind of had to work around it? How did it work?
It's a little, yeah. I mean, that was something, you know, you rely on the fact that Jack's a great musician and stuff he's done with Tenacious D and all that through the years. He just exudes it, and he's a great singer. And so, you know, with something like that, it's like you start with kind of the basic idea of what you want from the scene, and the fact that he's singing this insane song, this is tribute to his love for Princess Peach. It's so, the thing about it is that in reality, it's so earnest. It completely crosses into, you know, kind of this comedic kind of moment, but it's almost like it's almost not comedic on its own. It's just that it's so earnest. Of course it is, because it's goofy. It's Bowser. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, it's just the fact that he cares as much. It really, that's, to me, actually, Jack really perfectly, he c- captured the character, even when he's, you know, he's not singing, he's just doing his thing. He's so, so damn serious about like wanting to marry her, and the fact that he's willing to basically destroy like the entire universe in order to, you know, it's like, it's kind of sweet in a weird way, you know?
Yeah.
So what I was doing was, is like, I didn't play any for that, even for that scene, you know, how the piano playing is, but like for his score, for instance, for his themes, if you listen to them out of context, there is no comedy to them. It's like, it is the most, like the darkest, like most militaristic, like mid-century Wagnerian, whatever. It's just like, it is like, is dark as it gets, like Imperial March style kind of bad guy, villainous music. And I think the thing that's so cool about is the movie is the comedy is done completely straight. It's kind of like it's like, in fact, it's like kind of like the British comedy. It's like, that's like what I grew up on. Is like, you know, it's like you just do it straight, and like, so the music never really becomes like comedy music. So like out of context, that when people hear, you know, the suite and it gets into his themes, it's like, ah, da, 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 da. It's like, it is so kind of dark that him playing the character as he does, it somehow all works without kind of having to pander to goofiness, you know.
You brought up something really interesting there, which is like, don't score comedy comedically, which is something that I've always found really fascinating. So is the idea that you amplify the sincerity without necessarily overemphasizing those cue points in the comedy?
Yeah, like there's parts, there's like you're seeing where someone kind of says it, where you have a serious moment and someone says what, and then they just say the thing exactly, they'll like repeat it, and so the music like da, 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 it's like doing a very serious line, and then you repeat the exact line as if it's like, you know, literally just repeating itself, as opposed to doing some kind of pratfall kind of music when things are goofy. It's almost like if you see Mario barely holding on to a cart going a gazillion miles an hour over the Rainbow Bridge doing like loop-de-doops, and you're like, ah, you know, just completely out of control. It doesn't go into kind of what that is, the goofiness of it. It like becomes the most serious action, dramatic music, and it's just super on the nose. And you have to almost guard yourself to do it in a way that plays the most straight and resists the temptation to kind of go wacky. And then it plays so much more, and plays hilariously, because it's, of course, it's that juxtaposition. What it is what, like with Bowser, for instance, I'm not scoring him looking goofy, trying to do something that is, he thinks is evil. I'm scoring what he thinks he is in his own mind. Is totally, you know, I'm not scoring what the audience is thinking. The audience gets it. So I just score what's Bowser's thinking, or Mario is trying to pull something off. I score exactly what Mario is thinking. It's almost like the soundtrack of your own mind, which is why it's always awesome to watch someone walking through the airport with headphones on, and they're just like some older man kind of with tracksuit on, and kind of, you know, but in his mind he's probably listening to something, and he thinks he's, you know, Jason Bourne walking through the airport, just doing that. You can see on his face what he's listening to, just from the or smiling, kind of being happy-go-lucky, like as if they're, you know, tiptoeing through the tulips or whatever. So it's kind of it's like, to me, and I always did that growing up. I'm mentioning airports because I specifically remember as a kid, I loved putting on soundtracks, and either it would be like Rocky or Star Wars, or I put on some song that just made me feel like whatever. And then I put that on as if I was in a spy movie. I loved putting on James Bond. It was like, voodoo, you know, and I'm walking through the airport, just, I'm like 8 years old, just like, you know, like thinking I'm a spy, or people looking at me. I even feel like I sometimes would do this thing where, remember, my parents know that I walk like kind of like in slow motion, you know, like, yeah. Certainly, no, like I kind of like make it look like I was on film. And maybe it's just me, but I think that to me, that kind of weirdly enough informed how I score comedy or different. I think it's hilarious to see what people think they are. So I think you just do it from that POV, and then you're good.
Yeah, because I think from my point of view, I think I totally agree. Music has a really transformative element. If you're out in the world and you put a bit of music on and it has that visceral impact, if I put on something like Berlin Foot Chase from the Bourne Supremacy, where John Power, you mentioned Bourne there, you speed up.
Yeah,
exactly that. You start walking faster and it's like...
Oh, I can't... Totally, I cannot tell you. Who was it? I was trying to think. I was talking to someone who put on... I don't know if it was Fast and Furious or... I'm not sure what it was, but I got to remember. But they texted me and they said, you were responsible for the car crash I just got into.
Oh, wow.
It was, fortunately, it wasn't anything terrible, but apparently they just started kind of speeding up. And it was like they're just like they're on this kind of chase. It really kind of got away from me. I had to be careful about it. And of course, because, you know, if you have if you dread the gym and you want to go in there, what do you put on? You're not going to put on a waltz, you know. You're going to go to the gym and you're going to put something to motivate you to do it. And it informs all of our lives. It marks all the big events, weddings, funerals, you name it, everything in between. And it's really why music is so powerful. And it's why even scores exist. And even going back further, why it used to be that you would have an army and you would take about 5% of the conscription out of the army and have them play drums that pumped up the army, or they would blow in bagpipes to scare the hell out of the enemy that can't see what the hell's coming over the hill. And you hear, that's what bagpipes were. There's rah! And you know, it's just, there was an advantage and a reason to have music from very early on in order to change the psychology of human beings to get where it needed to be and motivate people to push themselves or whatever it might be. So that same concept is really, that's the forerunners of what I do and what other composers do. This is very interesting that's become, that we're actually a species that understands music in a way that motivates us emotionally. It's fascinating to me that's even the case. And it feels like a privilege to be able to understand music and be able to enjoy it, because we're unique in the animal kingdom in that way. We use it as for enjoyment and for motivation, you know?
I literally did it this morning. I was walking here and I kind of picked up the pace and I really needed to get here a little bit faster. And all I could think of was your Furious 7 theme. That literally got in my head. It wasn't even in my ears, or I wasn't even playing the music on a device. Like, all I could think of was the Furious 7 theme in my head, because I was about to come talk to you, and that picked up the pace. So that,
well,
that's literally,
I hope,
true.
It helped.
Yeah, it did. Oh yeah, totally. It totally helped.
Yeah, excellent.
For sure.
Fantastic.
Talking about,
that's a wild one too.
Oh, that's a crazy, I love that theme. It's a great theme. But I wanted to actually talk to you. I won't get too much into Fast right now, because hopefully I think we're going to have, I hope if you happen to come back, we're going to have another conversation about that in a month or two.
It is incredible. By the way,
yeah, I'm so excited for
you. Are it. Not really going to believe
about
it.
That.
It's it is so cool. Yeah, I love that. The Fast 10 is crazy.
Oh, it looks insane! It looks insane. So I think we'll do that before we get into the next show.
Yeah.
And we'll do I want to do a musical history of Fast and Furious. I think that'd be a really amazing thing to do. But
I'm really excited about that soundtrack.
Oh man, it's so good.
In particular, that one is. Yeah, it's a special one, very much so. Yeah.
So I think we'll do that in the next episode, if you're happy to come back and talk about your musical DNA for Fast and Furious. But very quickly, we'll just tap on it just real quick, just a kind of little preview, a little highlight. What can we expect from Fast X?
Oh my God. It is, what can I say? One thing, it's an incredible movie. And I've worked on enough. You know when it's really special. And I threw myself into this score in a way that just a very unique experience in that way, that harkens all the way back to kind of the entire kind of history of it. And it is just the most musically kind of challenging, pushing the envelope as far as it can go in terms of what I can do just as a composer, in terms of the emotion, the intrigue, the sonic palette of it and the musicianship and just writing for it just felt like different, but in a way that ties into even like Fast Five, and because of the story of, you know, which you've probably seen in the trailer, of how it kind of, there's a whole connection between going all the way back to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, 7, all of it. And the idea of Dante, the character who was our villain, Momoa, is such an incredible character. And just the theme that evolves from that is one of my very favorites I've ever done. It brings together kind of this feeling of cinema, kind of what we were talking about, when you really, it feels like it's elevating into experience where you can put on the music and it is not just kind of like merely action music in that way. It goes well beyond that as a musical challenge and kind of as an experience that you can watch the movie and you can also put on the soundtrack completely separately. And it is like a full on experience that also is informed by me even making Are We Dreaming and Awakening, which are music centric, music kind of at the center of an idea. And it's like all I've learned as a producer and as a composer, which I feel in the last few years doing those other two projects has made me grown by like a massive amount in the last even year. So I finally feel with Mario and with Fast 10, they are kind of, it's those scores are the beneficiaries of this work of me doing Are We Dreaming, me doing like nearly 500 songs for Are We Dreaming in the last, you know, whatever. The amount of growth I've had as a musician, as a writer, is it to me like the biggest spike I've ever had, which you're hearing some of that in Mario as well in its own world. But boy, Fast really is, I think, especially, I'm very proud of it and excited about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, to go back to Mario, I loved the really judicious use of the analog synth sounds. I thought they were placed very strategically, because I imagine it would be very easy to over-rely on them, right? To use them as a crutch.
Yeah, I wanted it to be something that would be part of the just kind of a natural tendency to the music. So I never wanted to be bound by kind of a system of rules of either, okay, we're going to do this, so we should use something this retro, like, or this or that. And I think that it could have been a huge danger of just becoming kind of a retro score that was like, oh, hey, you know, huh, look at that. Isn't that quaint? Because I think that does a disservice to the experience that we all had playing those games. The point isn't that it's retro, that those games existed then, so hey, let's just reference it. The point is that it's lasted all these years because it's an amazing universe that was created. And so the music needed to kind of be larger than that. And so when it's being used, it's something that I felt like as a timbre or a tone or a kind of a color would make sense if you didn't even know there was such a thing called Mario, that you're just hearing the music and when you're watching the movie, it makes sense in a very direct way, in a one-to-one ratio to the movie, as opposed to, hey, we're going to do a wink to the past, you know? But when they could do both, then great.
I love how many musical Easter eggs you've put in there as well. It's like we see that in movies the time, right? We see in movies the Easter eggs to franchises and previous franchises. We see it a lot in Scream 6, of course, as well. But what I love about Mario Brothers is the score is as full of Easter eggs.
Oh my goodness.
As the movie would be. And I love how it's really clear, man, that you dug really deep on this one. Like, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, there are some references that are insane. I mean, I think it's like hundreds of references throughout it. And the thing about it is that if someone doesn't know it, it just kind of is part of the score. So there might be an alto flute line that's playing and it's doing one melody that references it. And sometimes it's quite, since I play these games, there's no faking it. Like, there's no way I could have jumped in and been like, I want to learn this Mario. You know, it's part of who you are. So, like, for me, the thing, like, for instance, someone's watching a game like Mario Kart, and they know the Mario Kart they're kind of probably going to go to the main themes that they know. But for instance, I spent a lot of time like tweaking, picking out your what you're going to drive or whatever. And so you have, like, for instance, you know, those the holding rooms where you go and you select menus, and that's different music. Like, I know that stuff. Everyone knows that. You know what I mean? Like, when you play, when you really know a game, you even know that stuff. Like, that's permanently burned into your mind. And so, for instance, there's references to even like menu and game screens within the games, in between the games, that I'm referencing, even in like when they're looking at the carts, for instance, they're kind of deciding. So there's, you know, there's music saying, well, okay, they're deciding about the carts. To me, that kind of reminded me of the menu screen. So it's like the deep cuts are just out of control, and it's going to be interesting to hear, and I already am, from some people that have seen previews or listen to the soundtrack, to the number, to see if we'll ever be really like every single Easter egg will be found musically. It'll be fun to see.
Yeah, because it's almost like, I was just going to say, it's almost like genetic memory, is it? Like you say, you feel the music in your bones, and then you bring it into the project, right? It's something that you live with, and it's great.
Oh gosh, yeah, totally. It is there. In fact, there would be times where I'd be referencing something, and it'd be like, oh my gosh, it'd even be people that I talk to and that know it really, really well, Nintendo, or the directors who know it like the back of their hand too. And they're like, God, I thought I recognized that, but I didn't know that, you know. You know, so yeah. it's pretty wild, and it is really, really cool getting to know Kaji Kondo too. They're just such good people, and they really believe in the project. And there's a lot of trust to have other people jump on and kind of bring their vision of what they wanted to life. And I'm really proud of it.
Just in closing, it's been so much fun to talk to you. It's always a good time with you, Brian. Like, it's you, like,
oh, cool.
Always, man. We always have the best time, like, because we're all nerds, right? We just get lost
sure.
in music.
100.
But I just wanted to say thank you, but also just in closing, just one last question, which is for those at home, and this is a doozy, really. For those at home, the movie's about to come out, Super Mario Brothers. It's in cinemas here in the UK on the 5th of April. It's in theatres, I think, from the 7th. What kind of time are folks in for with this movie, Brian?
I think when they go, there'll be kind of a hope of what the movie could be. I really think it exceeds it. I think that it pulls you into the world of what Mario meant to you. And I think it's almost like a Rorschach. I've talked to so many different people that have been involved with it, watching it and have seen it, and to them, it's really beautiful to see that it really does capture, I think, what all of us hoped Mario could be as a film. And, you know, you go into that world and you're not going to want to come back out.
Brian Tyler and Sean, thank you very much, Sean, as well, for joining me.
Thank you,
so
guys.
Great to have you with
thank
us.
Thank you, Brian. That was brilliant.
Brian Tyler.
Thank you.
The legend.
All right.
thank you, sir. Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon. All right, great.
Take care.
All right, buddy. Bye.
We will destroy the Mushroom Kingdom!
Bowser is coming.
I'm not afraid. I'll do anything for my brother.
We're going to save him.
Yes! Fire!
You asked for it! This is fun!
Here we go!
The brilliant Brian Tyler there, who Sean and I had the great pleasure of catching up with about a week ago at time of recording this podcast, of course, to talk about his amazing work, and it is amazing, on the Super Mario Brothers movie soundtrack. If you haven't seen the film yet, I would not be deterred by reviews. I think if you like having a fun, bombastic, colourful, funny, uplifting experience at the cinema, especially if you've got young children as well, it is a fantastic film. I really did enjoy it. And hearing Brian's work in context was a real thrill as well. Super Mario Brothers movie is in cinemas right now. It's in 3D and 2D. Go and check it out at your nearest local cinema. And of course, the album, the brilliant album, is available now on Backlot Music. Sean, how are you feeling after that?
Yeah, I'm listening back to that again. I'm just delighted with that interview. Brian, like you said, is so full of beans and so full of life, and he evidently loves what he does, and he loves pushing himself across different projects, and you can hear from that interview, I think, how much he immersed himself in the musical language of Mario and Koji Kendo. And I always think it's really, really great when one artist honors and integrates the spirit of another. And I think Brian has done that really, really well here, tremendously well.
He's captured that Nintendo magic in a bottle, I think, there, for sure.
Yeah.
That's it for us this week. I say this week, so just to follow up on that, obviously, Brian did reveal to us during the show that we are indeed going to do a Fast and the Furious music special with him, talking about his work and his history with the Fast franchise. That is coming up. Thank you to him for agreeing to that. By the way, it sounds like I put him on the spot in the show and said, will you come back and do it? It is actually being arranged, and it's not something I didn't hold him accountable.
He was up for it.
He was fully up for it. It wasn't, because I know some people go, you kind of put him on the spot though, because I think the polite thing to do was just to say, yes, of course I will, because it would look weird if he said no. But he has previously agreed to it anyway before we did all that. So just to let you know, a bit of backstage magic, he is coming back to do that for sure, of his own free will, by the way, nothing to do with it.
And not making him.
But also, yeah, we have, so that is coming up. We'll probably work towards that nearer the time that Fast X is due to drop, which of course is in May in cinemas everywhere. In the meanwhile, go check out the album. As I say, it's on Backlot Music. About the Mark Mothersbaugh episode, that will come up next. It is of course the Easter holiday, so I think we should celebrate by releasing more episodes. So if you'll have us, we will, of course, bring you more episodes over the coming week. We do have an episode with Mark Mothersbaugh. It is in process. It is coming out. It is a wonderful episode. And also, shortly thereafter, we will release also a special, very, very special conversation we did with the incredible Rachel Portman as well. That's coming too. All you need to do is stay with this channel, at Need a Bigger Pod if you're going to our socials. It's We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod. If you're following us on all your favourite podcast platforms, whether that be Audio Boom, we're on Apple, we're on Google, we're on Spotify, we're on Deezer, Amazon Music, you name it, we're there. But yes, please do follow us on socials as well, at Need a Bigger Pod there. For all the latest updates and details, that's the best way to keep up to date with all the amazing composers that Sean and I are going to share with you over the coming weeks and months. And trust me when I say we have got some absolute stars to bring you, people of great interest to Sean and I, and I hope that you will share that interest too. Sean, any parting thoughts, sir?
Only that I am beyond thrilled to have spoken to both Brian Tyler and Tyler Bates in recent weeks, and we've got some absolutely terrific stuff coming up. Mark and Rachel are just absolutely delightful as well, so full of insights. It's brilliant to be able to embark on this journey with you, sir, and to talk to these artists. I'm delighted to be here.
And to you, sir, it is a great privilege and a thrill and a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to many, many more adventures. Thank you very much to you, sir. Thank you very much to you at home, if you're listening. And also thank you to all our friends that had anything to do with bringing this episode together, including our friends at 2B Entertainment, of course, who've been amazing over the last couple of weeks. I will give Cineworld a shout out, because I know they are very helpful in terms of being great hosts when we need to screen things in London. And I will also say thank you to View Cinemas as well, who are very helpful to me in making sure I get to look at things here in Portsmouth, where I am. And I know you also share some love for the Watershed as well. I know if you want to give them a shout out too.
Oh yes, colleagues, acquaintances, anyone at the Watershed in Bristol, one of the best art cinemas in the country, who've allowed me to host any kind of Q&As recently, anyone who's allowed me to get on stage with remarkable artists, including randomly recently Dunstan Bruce from Chumbawamba, who I hosted a Q&A with, and he was absolutely delightful. So yeah, thanks to the guys at Watershed.
Is that anywhere, can we see that anywhere online, or is there any evidence of that anywhere that we could follow that up? Because I'm very interested in seeing that, to be honest.
Unfortunately, it wasn't filmed, but the documentary called I Get Knocked Down that he's co-directed with Sophie Robinson, I believe is seeking distribution. It's been doing the circuits. So if you keep an eye on that, you will at least be able to see evidence of the film that he's made when it's released.
Okay, go and do that as soon as it's available. It sounds very interesting. I'm actually very intrigued by that movie. So yeah, do check that out. Thank you again to everyone. Thank you again to you. Go see Mario Brothers. It's really, really great fun. do that too. And if you want to know more about Mario Brothers, by the way, check out We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod. This week's episode does feature Chris Pratt, Charlie Day and Anya Taylor-Joy in interviews as well. That's all from us. Enjoy whatever you're going to do next, wherever you're listening to us. If it's still Easter when you're listening, have a fantastic Easter from both of us. And thank you very, very much to you, Sean.
And to you, Matt.